Hi, my name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm excited to bring you today's webinar that will discuss an important ruling for the ARM industry that came down last week, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals ruling in Taylor v. Financial Recovery Services. We'll explain exactly what that is and what it means for the ARM industry during today's event. This webinar is being generously sponsored by Maurice Butcher. I wanted to take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, including the Daily Digest email newsletter and the Getting to Know profile, as well as hosts webinars and delivers information across a multitude of communication channels. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope everyone will check out our new podcast, the Least Sophisticated Podcast, featuring two of today's speakers from Maurice Butcher, Eric Rosenketter, and Brent Yarborough. I hope you'll spend a few minutes every day checking out what the site has to offer. Now, let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. Donald Maurice is a partner at Maurice Butcher. He counsels clients in regulatory actions before the CFPB and other federal and state regulators, and in the development and testing of debt collection compliance systems. He serves as outside counsel to RMA International, as a regent of the American College of Consumer Financial Services Lawyers, and on the governing committee of the Conference on Consumer Finance Law. Eric Rosenketter is based in Austin, Texas, and focuses his practice on state and federal regulatory compliance and government affairs. He has experience as a federal lobbyist, chief compliance and ethics officer, and C-level executive. Brent Yarborough is based in Birmingham, Alabama. He counsels financial institutions, debt buyers, collection agencies, and law firms on regulatory compliance matters and defends consumer law claims, including those brought under the FDCPA, FCRA, TCPA, and TILA. The format for today's webinar will be a discussion moderated by myself. We encourage everyone to submit questions and we'll get to them when the discussion has concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. Also, today's webinar is an audio-only event. There is no video or PowerPoint component. A recording of the event will be made available in the coming days on accountsrecovery.net. Finally, before we launch into the discussion, I want to read the following disclaimer. The information shared today is not intended to be legal advice and may not be used as legal advice. Every effort has been made to ensure this information is up to date. It is not intended to be a full and exhaustive explanation of the law in any area, nor should it be used to replace the advice of your own legal counsel. Any opinions expressed are the opinions of the individual speakers and not their organizations. And with that, let's begin today's discussion. First, let's set the table, gentlemen, and Maybe you can walk us through the background of the case and exactly where we stand right now.
Okay, Mike, this is Eric, and I guess I'll wade into that a little bit. And good morning or afternoon, folks, depending on where you may be. I think if we're going to look at the Taylor decision, we should probably go back in time to the year 2000. The Seventh Circuit handed down a decision in a case called Miller versus McCalla. Now, that was a case in which the question was, what should a Dunning letter contain if the balance is actually accruing interest? And as many of you are aware, because that decision has been around for some 17 years, that disclaimer said, I'll read it quickly, as of the date of this letter, you owe blank, which is the exact amount due. Because of interest, late charges, and other charges that may vary from day to day, the amount due on the day you pay may be greater. Hence, if you pay the amount shown above, an adjustment may be necessary after we receive your check, in which event we will inform you before depositing the check for collection. For further information, write the undersigned or call 1-800 phone number. So that's pretty simple language. As safe harbors go, it did prove to be fairly safe for a good number of years, although there were several courts, particularly up east, that distinguished themselves from that language one way or another. Then along came Avila in 2016 in the Second Circuit. Again, that was a case in which interest was accruing, in that case, quite a bit of interest. In fact, the debt collectors in that case did not include the safe harbor language from Miller, and in fact, it included no indication whatsoever that the balance would be changing from day to day, which at 500% interest, I believe, was the matter that could be significant. Well, the court looked at that and found that there were three ways that the debt collector, in fact, could have protected themselves from liability. And that was number one, they did endorse the Miller safe harbor language that I just read. Number two, they said that if you simply provided in your Dunning letter that the amount of X was due by a certain date, that amount would be accepted by a certain date, the matter would be considered resolved. That also would be sufficient. And then citing Jones versus Midland, they said you could also itemize the amount and the rate of interest at which it was accruing, any additional fees or interest, that is. And of course, that would satisfy the situation also. So Avila wasn't a horrible decision. It gave some options. It did not say, however, that if interest was not accruing, that any disclaimers should be included in the letter. However, before I get to that, there was a case in 2017 called Carlin. And in that matter, again, interest was accruing, and it was, how should this be explained? And the court went one step farther in that case and took the Jones safe harbor that I just mentioned from Avila and expanded upon it and wanted a very itemized breakdown of the fees, charges, interest accruing, the rate of accrual, the basis for the fees. And that was a mortgage case and gave some consternation to folks in the credit industry, I think, more than anything else, because including all of that information, particularly on purchase and sold debt in some instances, although less and less these days, could prove to be a challenge. Not only that, many would argue that it would be completely confusing to the consumer to try to decipher what the debt would be, say, 6 months from now, based on the information you may provide. There were a number of other cases, of course, including the reverse Avila cases, which came out. Brent, you want to talk about those a little bit? I know that you and or Don, I know you guys have been involved in the reverse Avila cases.
Avila addressed, of course, the situation of where interest and balance is accruing fees and interest such that the balance on the day that a consumer pays could be different. And the concern that this Second Circuit addressed in Avila was that a consumer may get a letter and then pay the balance stated therein and then get the get a nasty little surprise that they still owe money and are subjected to further collection efforts. But the reverse of that is the theory basically that a collector must disclose that interest is not accruing. And some consumer attorneys were arguing that that if a consumer gets a letter that just states a balance and doesn't say anything about interest and fees, then they would assume that interest and fees are actually accruing, even though the Second Circuit in Avila said that a least sophisticated consumer would assume the opposite, which is that they're not accruing, but that they would assume that they are accruing and be confused about what they really owe and when they owe it. So there were suits filed saying that Avila stood for the proposition that you need to disclose one way or the other. And in other words, there must be a disclosure in every letter as to whether interest is either running or not running. So if it's not running, then you need to tell a consumer that.
And well, that sounds a little bit like the Taylor decision. John, were you going to say something?
I was.
Please do.
So first of all, welcome everyone. Thank you for joining us today. Took a look at the attendee list. So many people, friends and colleagues. It's great to have you here today. Looking forward to your questions. But let me step back and talk about just how this, I think, it came about, and then we could talk about Taylor and what happened there. Look, everyone who's in this space is now very compliance centric. You're all looking at proper text to use, and Miller goes a long way in helping us in that regard. So a lot of letters would use Miller language where they're accruing interest. But of course, that poses the question, what do you do when you're not accruing interest? So you don't want to use the Miller language, right? Because that presupposes that there's interest accruing. And we've all been through that post-charge off interest phase, and so many have stopped accruing interest. So what was happening was that a lot of people were not using Miller because they weren't accruing interest. And those letters, like so many others, find their way into the Second Circuit. You get the decision in Avila that says, oh, you've got to disclose if there's interest. And we have some very, I'll use the term creative, plaintiff's counsel in and around the New York metropolitan area, right through to Philadelphia, who come up with some very interesting concepts. And the concept that was presented in Taylor was that, well, if you're using something other than the Miller, you're not telling them that you're charging interest, and you might be. So that was something that was pled. So they would allege that you violated G and E because you didn't disclose interest. But then we began to see that if you weren't disclosing it, if you weren't charging interest, then you should have disclosed that, which frankly I thought was one of the craziest claims I've ever seen in some time. But Brent, I'll give it back to you to talk about Taylor and how this theory got its legs.
Well, I think the I don't know that it really got much in the way of legs. I mean, I think there were certainly a lot of lawsuits under this theory, and it's cost collectors a lot of money defending those suits and in some cases settling those suits. So you know, I think that the money that the consumer attorneys were making in some of the settlements were probably driving this more than anything the courts themselves were doing. The problem is it's interesting to look at the history of these cases. Avila and Carlin and Taylor were all handed down by the Second Circuit in March. Avila was in March 2016. Carlin was in March 2017. Now we get Taylor in March 2018. And it just goes to show it takes some time for the courts to kind of catch up. And as we're going to talk about, there's still some theories that maybe were unaddressed by Taylor, which may require another case from the Second Circuit to finally do away with those for once and for all.
That's right. Taylor's a good example of a reverse Avila case. I mean, here we've got a situation in which the creditor instructed the debt collector not to accrue interest or fees, period. They sent a series of collection notices to the plaintiffs in the case. They all had the same amount. It was an unchanging balance due in every single letter. And yet consumers claimed that this was confusing because in looking at the letters, the letters could imply that either interest was accruing or it was not. And the court found a hole in the screen door of that argument as they looked at it and really relied somewhat on the Seventh Circuit decision in Chue. I'm going to see if I can find that quote here. Here it is. I know you like this, Brent. We've talked about this before. If the debt collector is trying to collect only the amount due on the date the letter is sent, then he complies with the act by stating the balance due, stating that the creditor has assigned your delinquent account to our agency for collection and asking the recipient to remit the balance listed and stopping there without talk of the current balance. So they have relied heavily on the Seventh Circuit in terms of coming to this decision in which they rejected the plaintiff's argument. The only argument that they did not address, which we'll get to in just a bit, is what happens if interest is accruing in the background the whole time. That is to say that although the creditor has given the debt collector one amount to collect, what if the creditor's accruing amounts on their books in the background? What happens? Well, it turns out that the plaintiffs in this particular case brought that issue up a little too late, and so the court didn't address it. But we will get to that in just a few moments. Any other thoughts on the case, Brent? Don?
Yeah, well, to go back to Chue, I mean, as Eric, as you pointed out at the beginning, this all starts in 2000 in the Seventh Circuit. So the Seventh Circuit has been dealing with this disclosure issue for much longer. And it kind of baffled me that the case of Chue, which was a later Seventh Circuit case that expounded upon Miller, that case was not cited in I'm not sure if in any, but certainly not. There were a lot of the district cases within the Eastern District of New York and the Southern District of New York that were ruling in favor of the collector. I mean, they're good decisions from the district courts, but they weren't citing Chue. And I was looking for Chue to get cited here because what I say is that Chue shows the way. It it guides collectors and courts in how to interpret this disclosure requirement. So if you're not collecting fees and interest, just don't say anything about it. And that's eventually what the Second Circuit decided last week in Taylor. And they did drop a footnote citing Chewy. So I think we've got some alignment now between the Seventh and the Second Circuit on this issue and some good guidance. But Eric, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, what this says is if you can show, and one way to show this is what Don was talking about earlier, which or Eric was talking about earlier, which is multiple letters went out with the same balance, right? Which suggests that nothing, that balance is not changing. It's a static balance. So if we have a static balance, we don't have to say anything about fees and interest. One of the arguments that the consumer posed in Taylor was that a collector should have to do this because a consumer is going to want to prioritize her debts and pay the ones that are more urgent first. And so a debt such as the one in Avila that's accruing interest at 500%+ per year, that's one that a consumer should pay before they pay a static balance to avoid all that extra interest. And one of the nice things the Second Circuit did here is they have some language in the Taylor decision that says that a collector is not required to give that information. And a collector is not, the FDCPA does not require a collector to discourage prompt payment of static balances, is essentially what the court said. So I thought that was very helpful. So that theory was shut down. I guess one of the problems with this, and I think we'll get into this when we talk about what does this mean for the cases that are out there, is this is still driven somewhat on a fact basis. So the collector in Taylor was able to show that interest was not being collected. There was no accrual of interest or fees and that the balance was static. The consumer had no evidence that interest or fees were being added to their account. And so it may be tough to deal with on a motion to dismiss. It might be a summary judgment issue in most cases, depending on how they're pled. But consumers, to defeat, to get around Taylor, they're going to have to actually prove that interest is running. And I think what we're going to see is consumers trying to argue that they don't have to prove interest is running. They just have to prove it was not waived. I think that's going to be an argument. We're already seeing that argument in some district court cases right now. That if the creditor did not waive the interest and fees, then they are still accruing in the background, and that a collector must disclose that. And we may see that for a while longer, but I think Taylor put the writing on the wall for that theory as well. I don't think that theory is going to be around much longer, and I think the district courts will dismiss cases based on that. But unfortunately, that's not strictly within the holding of Taylor.
I agree. And of course, the bottom line is they distinguished, the court distinguished this case from Avila. And Avila, clearly the letter, I shouldn't say clearly, but the letter could have been interpreted to be misleading in that it didn't indicate that the interest was accruing. The court found in this case, well, how much more clear could this be? And I quote, prompt payment of the amount stated in Taylor and Klein's notices would have satisfied their debts. Does it become any more clear than that?
Right. And that's what I mean when I say that I think the writing is on the wall for this, but I suppose, or I know the consumer lawyers are going to argue that theory is left unaddressed and they'll probably continue to push it for a while. I just don't know how much longer it will last, but let me preface this. And Mike gave the disclosure earlier about this not being legal advice. So, but I think I should give another disclosure that, most of us who are lawyers, and I'm sure there are a lot of lawyers listening, most of us did not go to law school because we crushed physics and chemistry and things like that. But this reminds me of a principle. If you took physics, a principle, a thought experiment called Schrodinger's cat, where it's a thought experiment about quantum mechanics that involves a cat in a box. And if certain things occur, then the cat dies. If they, on a subatomic level, if certain things occur, the cat dies. If not, the cat lives. And the cat may exist both alive and dead because of quantum superposition, I think is what it's called, until it is observed, at which point it just is either alive or dead. And so I thought, the way that some of these theories sound to me, it reminded me of that principle. So I wanted to do a disclosure that basically says, interest is accruing on your account and it's not accruing on your account, and your account will exist in various states until it's observed at some point in the future. And if you need more information, consult an expert in quantum mechanics. That is wow. That is the way I would like to do it, because it is so absurd. That, and I think we're going to continue to see these theories, and you're welcome to use quantum mechanics to try to defeat it, that interest might be accruing, and maybe it's not accruing, and maybe the creditor could accrue it and might add it later. And there are all these different events which could occur in the future. But, you know, that's not what's really going on. What's going on is the collector has a static balance in collection, and therefore the appropriate thing to do at this point, following Taylor, is to say nothing about interest and fees, because the balance is static. And as Eric just pointed out, that language in Taylor that says the balance was static long enough that prompt payment of the account would have satisfied their accounts in full.
Right. And this is Don Maurice. That's really, I think, when we ask the question, what does this ruling mean for the ARM industry? Well, I think right off the bat, it means that when you're not accruing interest, in the simplest terms, then you don't need to disclose you're not accruing interest. So long as the amount due that's stated in that letter can be paid and satisfy the debt, then you should be fine. The other thing that we should talk about as you address here is accruing. And one of the questions that popped up, I think, really addresses that. So if you read through Taylor, you'll see that the court uses the term accruing mm-hmm. over and over again. And one of the excellent questions I think we have here is, so what if the creditor does not charge any post-charge-off or pre-judgment interest, but does charge post-judgment interest, right? So do we need then to include the Miller safe harbor language in such a case? So that's a hypothetical. And the way I would look at it is this. The interest that we're talking about here that may be charged is post-judgment interest. And I'm assuming at the time in this hypothetical that the letter is sent that there is no judgment. So if you don't have a judgment, I would read Taylor to mean that interest, that post-judgment interest was not accruing. And so if it was not accruing, then your argument would be there was no duty to disclose it because there is no duty to disclose interest that is not accruing. Put it another way, what if you sent a letter and included prior to judgment, pre-judgment interest that you could only charge if there was a judgment? Well, then you know there are plenty of cases that say you would be in violation because without the judgment, you can't charge the interest. So I think of Taylor supports the notion that when you want to remain compliant and when you want to send a letter in the context that you're not charging interest, then simply put the amount due. And as long as that's the amount due that reflects what the debt collector will accept this payment, you should be fine. I think what else it means for the ARM industry is that we do look at series of letters, and those are important. They're evidentiary in examining the least sophisticated consumer. And the reason why I think that's important is because prior to the decision in Taylor, there was a decision out of the Eastern District of New York, Islam versus American Recovery Service Incorporated by Judge Kogan. Judge Kogan took a very broad look at Avila, so broad that he, I think, presupposed how the Taylor decision would be handed down. And fortunately for everyone on this call, he got it wrong. But Judge Kogan was expressing, I think, his dislike of a broad reading of Avila. So what he said there was, and I found this to be the most disturbing part of that Islam decision, is that he wasn't going to look necessarily at all of the letters, which showed that the balance had not changed. He was just going to focus on the one letter because that's the focus of the suit. And what the Taylor court did is quite the opposite here and looked at all the letters. And I think that's going to be important to every one of you when you have to look at the world now post-Taylor, is that it doesn't solve all of your problems because it could be a fact issue, and I think we'll get into that later, as to whether or not interest was being accrued, we'll use that term. And the plaintiff's attorneys are going to be focusing on that. But at least if you have a series of letter, if it wasn't all about one letter and you have a series of letter with a static balance, you could point right back to Avila. You could even bring up Islam and show, yep, see, the judge here got it wrong. We do need to look at that when determining how to dispose of the case. So I think that's an important factor, too, for the arm industry. And I think what I found as the third most important thing is I really like the court's take on the principle that we're not going to read the FDCPA in a way that potentially can harm consumers and also harm the collection industry. And what do we mean by that? The court talks about, I think, Eric, you alluded to it, where if you accept what the plaintiff's attorneys are saying here, then you could see a result of everyone charging interest all the time, even when they don't want to. And I think that's important going forward when we talk about what the contract may say and whether you actually are accruing interest or aren't accruing interest. We're not going to read the FDCPA that way. The FDCPA doesn't mandate that you have to charge interest, and it doesn't. And we're not going to read it in a way that would compel creditors to charge interest. And we're not also going to read it in a way simply because we're going to take a very hyper-technical view of what a letter means. When at the end of the day, the whole purpose of the amount due is to give the consumer something to identify, to pay upon, and to close the collection process out. I think is a very strong point of Avila. It's just Taylor at the end, is that when read together, that was the concern in Avila. There was an amount stated. If you paid it, it wouldn't have paid the debt. Taylor says that when you can pay that amount, you're good to go. And we want to stick closely to both protecting consumers and also allowing compliant debt collectors to do their job. So three important things I take away from that decision.
Let me follow up quick, Dom, with a quick question. You mentioned that the series of letters matters more now than it did, say, a week ago. Is that an argument or a strategy where collection would be better off sending more letters now to sort of create that series?
Well, you know, Mike, I think what happens is, and what has a lot of debt collectors scratching their heads is that when they're hit with the reverse Avila claim, it doesn't make any sense to them because they've already sent a bunch of letters. They've sent 3, 4, 5 or more letters, all stating the same amount, and they don't understand why they're getting sued on this theory that interest is accruing, at least on information and belief, interest is accruing, when they haven't told the consumer anything but the fact that the balance is static. I think it goes more to that, not whether or not, I mean, whether you should send a letter or not send a letter is really something that you need to consider from a business standpoint. As long as it's compliant, then you're fine doing it. But I think it helps get around what Islam was talking about, the other case where the judge was going to focus on that one letter, and that I can show now, pointing to Taylor, that the least sophisticated consumer or debtor must read letters side by side, something that Islam said that the court would not require. But I think Taylor clearly says the opposite, that you can consider all of these letters and that the balance wasn't changing, and that supports it. So that's going to help. I think that's going to help on the question of accruing interest, regardless of what the contract says. As well, you can look to those letters to support your position. Of course, if you have a letter where the balance changes, it's a whole different ballgame. But at least in the cases that I've seen, that has not been the case, and that debt collectors have been sued where the balance has remained the same. And you know, just this morning, I started sending out my letters to the on these cases where that's where that was the situation. There was no change in the balance. And saying, are you going to dismiss this case now? I haven't gotten any responses yet, but I think that some are going to be hard pressed in light of Taylor instructed as part of its analysis.
Yeah, Mike, let me add on to that. This is Brent. So I think Don's exactly right. I mean, those additional letters are further proof. It's not the only proof, though, so I wouldn't recommend sending a letter just to establish that the balance isn't changing. As Don pointed out at the beginning, we have been defending a number of these reverse Avila cases, and you know, so some of the other proof that can exist is the charge-off statement. If you've got a credit card that charged off, and the balance is static after that, then you could point to the last credit card statement, and it's probably going to match that letter. So there's in many cases there's going to be a number of months, maybe sometimes even years, from the date of that charge-off statement to the date of the letter that you've been sued over. And so you can say, well, look, this balance hasn't changed in all of these months or years. I think that's other good evidence. So I think it's helpful. It's another thing that to prove that interest is not being added to the account if you've got multiple letters stating the same balance. But there's plenty of other things to show that as well. So it shouldn't be necessary to send a letter, additional letters just for that purpose.
Okay, that definitely answers the question. I appreciate that. Let's talk about, we've talked about reverse Avila. I know that, you know, there are a lot of lawsuits out there that are still pending. Many of them have been stayed, sort of pending the outcome of Taylor. Can you talk about collection agencies that have these kind of lawsuits that have been filed against them, what the Taylor ruling means for them?
Sure, Mike. This is Don Maurice. So, strangely enough, I was in court in Brooklyn on Thursday when Taylor came down, and on a reverse Avila case. And the judge on that case wanted to talk about it and its impact there. The judge noted that the opinion was authored by Judge Calabresi and felt strongly about the impact that Taylor had on these reverse Avila claims in an adverse material way to the plaintiff. So that was a putative class action, and in that case, discovery was limited on the issue only of whether the creditor was accruing interest. So we weren't even going to look at class discovery, which is terrific right off the bat. And if you feel comfortable that you weren't accruing interest, then you know, you've got your series of letters and the other evidence that Brent talked about. I mean, this is going to help tremendously, especially for those cases that are stayed. And there are so many of these cases out there. This is, frankly, it almost is probably a docket fuller for many judges in ED and Southern District, I think it provides now them a path to dispose of these cases, and it provides defense counsel with that path as well. And I think we're going to see in some of them, dismissals off the bat. Others, like I saw already on Thursday, we're going to see plaintiff's counsel saying, well, it's going to be a question of whether the contract was accruing interest and whether or not that had to be disclosed. There's language in Taylor to address that. And the court talks about the instructions from the creditor to the debt collector not to accrue interest, which I thought is something that defense would be picking up on, so that if the instructions were not to accrue interest, and that's what the debt collector was doing, not accruing interest, that should be fine too. So it's going to have clearly immediate impact. I think it's going to have a favorable impact on at least allowing these cases to move on a quicker path. And a quicker path should mean less fees. And I think in some instances, we're going to see dismissals.
Yeah, I think that's, this is Brent. I think that's right. I think it's going to depend on how they were pled. So some of the older ones where they were saying, hey, you've got to tell us if interest is not running, those cases should just be dismissed. I don't know that they're going to do it, but they should be dismissed. What we've seen more recently, as we talked about a couple of times here, is this theory that interest is running and maybe just not being collected. And if they've alleged that, then you know, they probably won't dismiss. They'll probably push through discovery or force you to file a motion for summary judgment. But as Don just pointed out, we think the Taylor decision is very helpful with that theory as well. And my prediction, again, is that courts are going to shut that down at the district court level. And then if a case on that theory goes up to the Second Circuit, my hunch is that the Second Circuit will also put that theory to bed for good.
There's another case out there, Brent, though. I know many on a call probably familiar with it. It's on appeal that is going to go to that second issue.
Right.
Of DeRosa. Contract, DeRosa. Right, the DeRosa. And Brent, why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Right, well, DeRosa is another case. I believe it was handled by the same plaintiff's counsel as Taylor. And that firm has had a lot of these cases. So those of you out there facing these post-Avila cases are very familiar with them. But as I think Eric pointed out earlier, they tried to bring up this theory that, hey, the contract calls for the accrual of interest, or, you know, law provides for the accrual of interest, so you've got to disclose that. In Taylor, they tried to bring up that tactic on appeal without properly arguing it in the district court. So the court in Taylor would not address it, although I think they, as Don pointed out, they put in some language that kind of does address it, although you can make the claim that it's technically dicta and not the holding. But from what I've seen of DeRosa, I think that they can make that argument and will make that argument on appeal in DeRosa. So the Second Circuit may have a shot at shutting that theory down in the DeRosa case. Now, the DeRosa filed his brief on February 13th. From what I saw in the Second Circuit's docket, the collector's brief is due on May 11th. So we're probably looking late summer at the earliest before we would see a decision in the DeRosa case, but it's certainly something to watch for to maybe take care of these remaining items hanging out there after Taylor.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the facts in Taylor, it's not clear whether the creditor itself was still accruing interest. The decision simply states that the instructions from the creditor to the agency were not to accrue interest. So that is, I think, why DeRosa becomes important. Mm-hmm. But, you know, one of the questions that was asked is, what if there's no instructions from the creditor, but the agency simply does not charge interest? So, I mean, again, going back to what we see in Taylor from the decision, the strongest point you would have, I think, in that hypothetical would be the argument of whether or not payment of that amount would dispose of the collection activity. And what the court said in Taylor, I think, that supports that is, this is a quote, "The difference is that while the message was prejudicially misleading on the facts of Avila," mm-hmm. meaning there what the court said was that if you paid the amount that was stated in the letter, collection would not be disposed of. But here the court says, on the facts of this case, it was accurate. Prompt payment of the amount stated in Taylor's and Klein's notices would have satisfied their debts. So to that question, that hypothetical, I guess that's what you would have to say is whether or not payment on the amount that the agency said was due would have disposed of that debt. Of course, if there were no instructions from the creditor, now you are venturing outside of Taylor. At least that is how you're going to be argued against on that theory, because Taylor, the close facts of Taylor were that the instructions were not to charge interest. But I still believe that you've got something, because the payment to the consumer would be a disposition of the debt, would have, as the court said, satisfied their debts.
You're right, Don. And you, at the end of Taylor, and you mentioned this before, they pick up on the point that even if the creditor had the right to accrue interest, the notices were not misleading, right. And I'll quote, because no interest or fees were being charged, and Taylor and Klein could have satisfied their debts by making reasonably prompt payment of the amount stated in the notices.
Yeah. Yeah. It becomes a really important concept as to the amount due and what it does if it's paid. It just, they tie very neatly together. So hopefully DeRosa puts that question to bed. And so that when we look at this question in the future, we do look at the amount due in the letter, right? And we don't have to do an analysis of state law and waiver and whether interest or other fees are waived, even if they could have been accruing under the contract, which could just be another mess. But again, maybe this summer, maybe sooner, maybe they're all geared up after Taylor to put that second part of it to bed. To address all that underlying litigation. Look, the courts are aware of it. I mean, the courts, like, you know, when you go to talk about the case, they say, is this another reverse Avila claim? So they're quite aware of it, and they got a lot of stuff to do other than FDCPA cases, and they want closure as well, just like we all do. That's the good thing about what we saw in Taylor and hopefully what we see in DeRosa soon.
Do any of you, or do all of you, think that this is the end of Taylor, or do you see that this decision being appealed to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court deciding to hear arguments on this?
So this is Brent. I don't know. I mean, I suspect this is the end of Taylor. One thing that they could do is move for a rehearing of Taylor within the Second Circuit. They could ask for what's called a rehearing en banc, which is because the Taylor decision comes from a three-judge panel. That's what most of these decisions from circuit courts that we see are three-judge panel decisions. They could ask for the entire circuit to sit and reconsider this. People may be familiar with that process because we just saw it happen in the PHH and CFPB case down in the D.C. Circuit. But typically, courts will only take a case for rehearing if reconsideration is necessary to secure or maintain uniformity of the court's decisions, or if the proceeding involves a question of exceptional importance. And while this case has been really important for us, in the scheme of federal law, it probably does not rise to that level. So I don't expect to see that kind of a review. And also, as I think most people know, the Supreme Court, it can take appeals from the circuit courts, but they do so in a very, very low percentage. I'm not sure what the exact percentage is now, but it's a single digit number. And typically when you see a case, when you see review granted by the Supreme Court, they're dealing with a case that conflicts with a prior Supreme Court decision. So they've got to take it up and correct it. Or it conflicts with the decisions from other circuit courts, what we call a circuit split, which is one of the reasons we've seen FDCPA cases go up before and may in the future, but we don't have that here. There's no circuit split. And they also will take cases where there's an important question of federal law and that should be settled by the Supreme Court to establish some uniformity and some guidance. And again, it's important to us, but it's just not important in the whole scope of federal law. So my prediction is that this is the end of Taylor, but that doesn't mean that there won't be efforts to get some additional review of it. I think the thing to look at less in this case and more to turn our eyes to DeRosa, as Don was talking about.
Yeah, and I think the other thing about this case is that it exists because of an interpretation of Avila, an interpretation that a group of advocates had on what the Second Circuit meant in Avila. And now you have the Second Circuit telling that group, no, you got our case wrong. So I don't think that the Supreme Court is going to be interested in telling the Second Circuit what it meant in its own decision. I think that this has to be the end of it, at least on the facts that we have here. And it was, you know, you love to see that with the closure that the Second Circuit is giving to the extent of Avila. And really, for those who want to look into this further, go back and read that Islam case where Judge Kogan was of the opinion that Avila should be read very broadly. And I thought at the time when I read that decision, he was sending a message up on this case, on Avila. And you could read Avila broadly, and that's why you got this type of reverse Avila claim, because they were reading it broadly, and now it's been constrained. So sometimes, as a good friend of mine who's a consumer advocate always warns defense counsel, be careful what you ask for, and certainly here, I think on the consumer advocate side, and I don't even know if we can call this consumer advocacy, on the plaintiff's attorney side, be careful what you ask for, because you just might get the opposite result. And that's exactly what happened here, in a very strong opinion on what was meant in Avila.
Okay, so let me ask you, let's put a hypothetical out there. I'm running a collection agency. I've got a letter campaign that's queued up and ready to go. What changes should I be making to those letters, if at all, today based on this ruling?
Well, before anyone answers that, do not use Brent's physics disclaimer, whatever you do.
Come on.
avoid talking about quantum mechanics. But go ahead, guys.
I would agree with that. Don't put that in your letter campaign. I could make a case for using it in one letter, though, if Taylor had not gone the right way, or if DeRosa doesn't go the right way, I could make the case for using it in one letter and stick it out there like bait. But I agree with Don. That was for amusement purposes only, even assuming it was amusing at all, which it probably wasn't.
No. Well, Mike, this is Eric. With regard to your question, I'm going to paint with broad strokes here. Now, all collectors have different creditor clients. They've all got different credit agreements. So obviously you need to look at the specific facts of each client's needs and what they're sending in their letters and what their arrangement is with their clients. But if interest is not accruing, generally speaking, it goes back to a podcast that Brent and I did a couple of weeks ago, where we referred to the Seventh Circuit decision in Boucher, in which the court found that don't use a safe harbor if it doesn't apply to the facts of your circumstances. So, in fact, applying that to this, if you don't have interest or fees or other charges accruing, don't use the safe harbor language from Avila. Number one, it's misleading. Certainly the argument will be made that it's misleading. And if you're putting that in an initial written communication, I could argue, and certainly some folks might, that it implies a false sense of urgency. You're trying to get the consumer to pay more quickly by stating that these fees and interests are accruing when in fact they're not, trying to get them to pay sooner rather than later. So no, if no interest or fees are accruing, then I would not, generally speaking, use the Avila safe harbor language. Now, that said, there are some other things that we need to consider. And Don mentioned the Islam case, and that always comes back to mind, because in that case, the court objected to the use of current balance in a letter. I would suggest not using the phrase current balance, perhaps, or as of the date of this letter, because that does tend to imply that the balance could be a moving target. Don, you're going to...
In a no-interest case. In a no-interest case.
Yes, absolutely, yes. Absolutely. Yes. And that's strictly what I'm referring to, is in a no-interest case, stay away from language that would in any way imply that that the balance is a moving target. And other than that, I think you just need to be aware that any safe harbor is not necessarily safe in other jurisdictions. Certainly, we saw with the asset acceptance language from the Middle District of Florida from some years ago that courts have not relied on that and found that the phrase, we will not sue you for it, in the context of out-of-statute debt, could be misleading because the law dictates it rather than the collection agency's decision not to sue on it. Likewise, with regard to other consent orders or other safe harbor language, it's not a guarantee that it's going to be safe necessarily.
Right. And Eric does, Don and I have been really busy with these reverse Avila claims and similar cases. Eric does a lot of letter reviews, and so I know he's dealing with this fairly often. But Eric, I assume you'll agree with me that I think anytime there's a case like this that talks about letter language, it's a good opportunity to review your letters. I would suggest not overreacting to something right away, but do a letter review and make sure, because Eric makes a very good point. If you are using the safe harbor language, even on a static balance, I mean, this case now says, you don't have to say anything. So taking that out is good, but also looking at just the fields above, as Eric pointed out, I mean, if it says current balance instead of just something like balance due, or if it has an opening sentence that says your balance as of the date of this letter, those are phrases that courts have found to imply that the balance is actually dynamic and not static. And so, you got to take a holistic approach to the letter and look at all these different things and make sure that they fall within whatever new requirements are set. And I think this case also, the fact that Taylor came down this way, vindicates those of us who, in the face of all this litigation, did what I think is sometimes the best thing. And it's hard to do. I mean, look, most of us that are lawyers or compliance officers or in-house counsel, you probably didn't get to that position by doing nothing very often. I mean, you're very proactive and you take charge and you take action, and that's how you succeed. But in this case, a lot of people are looking at the amount of litigation and also reading into the oral argument of the Taylor case before the decision came down when it was argued. The recording is made available of these cases, and the one of the judges on the panel was, it sounded like suggesting, hey, why wouldn't it? In fact, I think he even said something like to the collector's attorney, wouldn't we do your client a favor if we ruled against you in this case, but gave you a safe harbor to use in situations like this to explain that interest is not running? So we heard from a lot of people saying, wow, that sounds pretty scary. Maybe we should be coming up with new disclosures or changing our letters before Taylor. And I think this case provides a good example of when it's, when doing nothing is the best thing. And because that's, that turns out to be what the court agreed with, is that saying nothing in the face of a static balance is the best option. So I would just take this opportunity to say, whenever you're doing these type reviews or ever questioning your procedures, you may have to do something in many instances, but don't do anything until someone has at least made the argument for nothing. Because sometimes doing nothing is the best option.
No, that's absolutely true, Brent. And certainly when Avila came down, there were plenty of folks who threw the Avila safe harbor language or the Miller safe harbor language into their letters, even though no interest was accruing. And that didn't work out for a lot of folks in terms of the number of lawsuits and volume.
We've only got a couple of minutes left here. There was a question that was emailed in the other day that I wanted to ask, and that is, will agencies still need to provide proof that they are not collecting interest in order to prevail? I think attorneys will allege upon information and belief just to overcome the pleading hurdle, even though they have no good faith basis for making such a claim. What steps would you recommend to cut short litigation in these instances where the agency is not collecting interest?
I'll start. I'll take that to begin, and I want to turn it over to Don, I think, for the second part. But just in terms of, do you have to prove that you're not collecting interest? I mean, as a matter of principle, no. If they're the ones making the claim that interest is being charged and that it should be disclosed, so they've got to prove that interest is being charged, and it's not enough just to plead it. And that's the difference between a motion to dismiss. If they say upon information and belief, the interest is accruing pursuant to the contract or pursuant to this state law or whatever it might be, that might be enough to get them over that hurdle. But on a motion for summary judgment, they're going to they will have to actually produce evidence to support their claims. And so I don't think you have to prove it, although, coming up with those things we talked about earlier, a series of letters to say the same balance, the fact that the balance you're trying to collect matches what was on the charge-off statement, things like that, proof that your creditor client did not ask you to collect interest or actually instructed you not to collect interest, all that is good proof that you can use on a motion for summary judgment. But technically, they have to prove you're charging it, not the other way around.
Yeah, and this is Don. I mean, there are some courts that would say that that type of allegation, since it is the crux of the entire FDCPA claim, can't be made on information and belief. Not all of them. Mm-hmm. But that gets us back to the Iqbal Twombly and that whole analysis. You know, you in that instance, you have your counsel, draft a letter. If you've sent multiple letters, for example, all showing the same balance, explaining, you know, you got it wrong. And I'm sure that you wouldn't want to bring something like that where you got it wrong. But, you know, between now and DeRosa, you're still going to have that "I really don't care what you were doing" argument. It's what the contract said, and you're going to be going down that path, I think, in the near term, for those that want to spin the wheels until they get their settlement check. I think that's where you'll see some of it going, unfortunately, until we get some closure on DeRosa.
Agreed. I think that's right. I think what they'll say is, "I don't have to prove anything. You have to prove a waiver." They're going to try to turn it on us and say, "You have to prove that interest and fees were waived." And you know, I just don't think that's going to work. I think if they're saying, "Hey, you've got to prove a waiver," then if that's all they've got, in my opinion, they lose. But I guess we'll see how the district courts deal with that over the next few months and what the Second Circuit says in DeRosa when that opinion comes down.
Yeah, if the concluding paragraph of Taylor says anything, that that argument in the future should fail, we would hope.
All right, well, I don't see any other questions. We're almost running out of time, so I wanted to give each of you guys a chance to maybe summarize, provide some words of wisdom to everyone as we head off into the rest of our days and wrap it up. Who wants to go first?
This is Don. I'll go first. So, I want to give a lot of credit to the persons who fought on Taylor, because you know someone had to obviously take this up and get it before the Second Circuit. We got this positive result, so they should be complimented for that, because you know it saved a lot of other people a lot of costs, and it's good to see the Second Circuit look at these types of hyper-technical arguments and analyze it as to what kind of impact these have on consumers, and that it could be harmful to consumers to adopt this. And that was very pleasing for me. So I think overall, obviously, it's a great decision, but just the rationale of it really is pleasing for me.
Yeah, I'd second that, Don. It's a refreshing decision to see common sense actually prevail in the Second Circuit, which has been missing with regard to some of these Second Circuit decisions on the reverse Avila claims. My only word of advice would be that when you see a safe harbor, don't have a knee-jerk reaction to it. Consider it. Consider whether it applies to you before incorporating it into your letter series. And likewise, when a decision like Taylor comes out, consider whether or not you take them out carefully also.
Yes, I think it's all been said. Yeah, this is an example of that paying the good fight pays off. I mean, fighting the good fight pays off. And I think Eric made my other point, which is that, just be very careful and don't try to get ahead of it. Don't try to get ahead of the courts on disclosures. I think we got to follow the court guidance. It's tempting to try to be proactive, but I think one of your panelists in the webinar last week on defending reverse Avila claims said it best. It's unless it's a best practice, it's probably better not to try to get ahead of the courts on those things. And just to that point, I think we should thank Mike and the panelists from last week, because I think they carried the umbrella on Taylor for us, which is by that, I mean, when I think it's going to rain here, I carry an umbrella and then it never does. So I think by doing that great webinar last week, we made the reverse Avila cases, at least one of the theories, practically go away. So you guys all carried the umbrella for everyone.
Hey, just let me know if there are any other cases that we can maybe try and see if we can get lucky again on. But before I let everybody go, I want to thank Brent, Eric, and Don for their insights and their time today. This webinar definitely would not have been possible without their participation. I also want to thank Maurice Witcher for sponsoring today's webinar. Please go to www.mauricewitcher.com to learn more about the company. Thanks to everybody who participated, who signed up, who asked questions. Really appreciate your continued support. Please stay tuned to accountsrecovery.net for more news and webinars in the very near future. A recording of this event should be posted up in the next day or so. And I hope everyone enjoys the rest of your day. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, folks. Thanks, Mike.